Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach, and we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
Before we get started with this week's theme, we want to share some prison-related news.
Critical Resistance, an organization that works to end the prison industrial complex, recently released a report about Donald Trump's pro-policing executive orders. Just after swearing in Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, Trump signed three executive orders that, quote, bolster, back, and expand the authority of law enforcement and policing in the U.S., unquote. These orders were celebrated by the Fraternal Order of Police, a union with over 330 cops whose interests are served by the new legislation. Although the current administration points to the threat of increased crime to justify these orders, a recent report by the FBI shows that crime rates remain at historical lows. In response to this news, Critical Resistance stated, quote, "We know that these actions will impact our communities, materially, emotionally, and socially. We remain resolute in our commitment to resistance. We look to you all, our comrades, allies, and partners in struggles, to strengthen our way forward. As the enemy is attacking on many fronts, we must back each other and deepen our commitment to the struggle against policing and white supremacy," unquote.
In late February, the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit Court in Chicago reversed a lower court's ruling, allowing the case of Nicholas Glisson's go to trial. Glisson starved to death after just over a month inside the Indiana Department of Corrections. The IDOC had refused to make provisions for Glisson's care and feeding, even though Glisson's ability to swallow was limited by the after effects of a cancer surgery. His mother, Alma, brought the case against the IDOC and its privatized healthcare provider, Corizon, seeking justice for her son under the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. Until the appeals court's ruling, though, her suit has been blocked under the claim that this was an exceptional circumstance.
The Southern Poverty Law Center and Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law recently filed a class action lawsuit against Louisiana public officials for denying poor people their constitutional right to counsel by failing to establish an effective statewide public defender system. Louisiana has the highest incarceration rate of any state in the country. According to Kristen Clark, president of the Lawyers Committee, Louisiana has the most broken public defender system of any U.S. state. She said, quote, "They lock people up at alarmingly high rates and then fail to provide lawyers to navigate their way through the criminal justice system. Many of our clients have literally spent months in jail without any contact with an attorney," unquote. Last year, a funding crisis in Louisiana forced 33 of 42 public defender offices to stop accepting cases or to place clients, many of whom were in jail, on waiting lists. The Central Park Five was a group of African-American men who, as teenagers, were wrongfully convicted of raping a white jogger in Central Park and forced to serve prison sentences for a crime they did not commit. Now exonerated, three of the Central Park Five, Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, and Youssef Salam, are determined to do their part to see that innocent people are not incarcerated in the future. They recently participated in an ad that debuted in late February to support legislation that would mandate the electronic recording of police interrogations, as well as new procedures on evidence-based eyewitness identification. The ad is part of a digital and cable TV campaign initiated in conjunction with the Innocence Project and New York Hotel Trades Council. The ad indicates that since 1989, 223 wrongful convictions have been overturned in New York State. 76 people were convicted because of misidentification by eyewitnesses, and 34 because of false confessions.
Over the next two episodes, we'll be sharing an interview with Aaron Azura about immigrant detention and the struggle of refugees in Australia. While the history of racism and exclusion there throws light on America's own repressive apparatus, we were drawn to Aaron's story by the fierceness of the resistance inside the detention centers and the solidarity between refugees and organizers on the outside at Woomera. In 2002, a protest camp outside this detention center led to the destruction of its fences and a mass breakout by detainees. As the ICE raids accelerate and the construction of the wall approaches, this is a story we must all hear.
So Australia is a settler colonial state. It was settled by the British in the 18th century, and a large indigenous population inhabited Australia over 100 languages and lots of different groups. And the indigenous people were, a large population of them were basically annihilated across the 19th century. So race functions differently to the U.S. in that there isn't an acknowledged history of slavery, but there's a long history of white settler colonial attempts to understand indigenous people as non-inhabitants through a logic called terra nullius, or basically the idea that the land was empty when settlers came. That, you know, it's a majority white settler population, and so British ideals of, I guess, the crown have been really important. Just like the U.S., there's a history of importing non-white labor to meet a demand for cheap labor, purely in the late 19th century and during Australia's gold rush. Many Chinese laborers were shipped to Australia, and as well as that, indentured laborers from the Pacific Islands. That history of immigration of people of color has also brought with it a history of various forms of exclusion, points where Chinese people were, you know, in high demand, and then when they weren't, various forms of, you know, excluding Chinese and Pacific Islanders in the 19th century. And then through the 20th century, again, really similar to the U.S., desiring white European immigration, and white as in very Northern European immigration to begin with. And then gradually after the Second World War, the demand for labor and bodies to perform work was so great that they opened that up to Southern Europeans, and then gradually to various other kinds of people. So in the first half of the 20th century, there were language tests where the law was that immigration officers could set a language test in any language that was deemed to be, that was kind of on a list. So you would get immigration officers getting people to write out a dictation test in Gaelic or Russian, for example. And when people failed that, that was grounds for deporting them. And that was understood or designed to be a kind of racial test to be able to exclude anyone who wasn't white. But in the second half of the 20th century, you know, the kind of understanding of Australia as a humanitarian nation began to emerge. Or the more humanitarian nation, and especially in the late 70s, there was a wave of refugees from Vietnam and Cambodia and Southeast Asia that were taken in under a fairly left-leaning government, and that started a kind of self-image of Australia as a kind of democratic haven for refugees. And that brings us to the last 30 years, where because Australia is an island, it's pretty difficult to kind of, you can catch a plane and claim asylum, but the majority of asylum seekers over the last 30 years have come to Australia by boat from Indonesia or from Papua New Guinea. And so because those refugees are understood in a kind of nationalist public imagination to have not gone through due process through the United Nations or through kind of applying for refugee status outside of the country, they've been understood by a variety of governments and popularly as queue jumpers. And there's a huge history of nationalism and white nationalism on the left and the right in Australia, and successive governments have used that image of queue jumpers as a way, as a kind of dog whistle, to whip up panic about non-white invasion from the north. And so that's the kind of background. And a Labor government, which is the, I guess, the U.S. equivalent of the Democrats in the mid-90s, brought in a policy of what was called mandatory detention, which meant that anyone who came to Australia by boat and applied for asylum or asked for asylum on landing in Australia was detained automatically. And then you had to be, you were detained in a, basically in prison while your claim for asylum was assessed. That is still the policy, and the policy, I can talk a little bit more about how the policy has changed, but at the moment, things have gotten so bad, actually, or the situation has gotten so dire that the Australian government has moved detention centers offshore and has actually said that they're not taking any boats. Any people that, like, basically it's really hard for people to land on the Australian mainland now. Boats are intercepted at sea, and people are shipped off to islands in the Pacific. So, yeah, it's a really very deliberately racist policy that's been challenged for many, many years. In major cities in Australia, there are a lot of immigration kind of settlement or resettlement centers. And because there were huge waves of immigration during the 50s and 60s, there's a kind of infrastructure that's built for people to be housed. And so some of the detention centers became more carceral forms of those immigration resettlement centers. So there's a couple, there's many in major cities that basically they just built, you know, kind of fences and, you know, enclosures around these resettlement centers. Later, as the number of people who are coming to Australia increased, and particularly because there, you know, there's wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran throughout the 90s and into the 2000s, and particularly after the war on terror started, the number of people who were seeking asylum really increased, and the government decided that locating detention centers in the desert would be a good idea because they were very isolated. It would be much more difficult for people to visit detainees, to do solidarity, or to figure out what was happening inside them. So a number of detention centers were built in really remote areas that took, for example, 6 to 8 hours to drive to from a major city. And one of them was Woomera Immigration Detention Center, and that was located in South Australia. Incidentally, or not coincidentally, it was located on government land that had been a military base, and around that area there are ongoing military bases, but also very close to the site of nuclear testing in the 1950s and 60s. So that, I guess, gives you an idea of what the logic was, which is to place people as far away from other people as possible and as far away from any documentation or witnessing or oversight about how detainees were housed, what access they had to, for example, whether children were able to go to school, what kind of health care they were getting, etc. There are some contradictions between the fact that the Australian government was placing detainees in extremely remote environments. I should also mention that, you know, Australia is a very hot country, and in the desert, the weather is really hot all year round. So the conditions were really terrible, and they continue to be terrible in new detention centers, but Woomera is a a real example of a complete crisis of basically, I think it's really quite equivalent to Guantanamo in the kind of conditions that people were in. They were housed in really thin buildings that didn't have any heat or any temperature control. So people were not only hot outside, but were really hot inside. And there were constant problems with people getting dehydrated, overheating, or getting sunstroke. There were a lot of problems with people not being able to contact lawyers. So one of the process is that you apply for asylum, and then while your case is being looked at, you're able to contact a lawyer. But because it was so remote, it was difficult for lawyers to get out there. People were housed in really small dwellings with too many people to a room. There was lack of access to telephones. So there are huge problems. And as detention centers, there was a long process also of people visiting somehow and documenting what was happening inside. But also detainees were trying desperately to tell people what was happening. So that is when, probably in the late 1990s, is when you start to see a lot of protests happening that are initiated by detainees. At WUNRA, there was an initial breakout by all of the detainees from the entire facility. And because it was so remote, their technologies of keeping people inside weren't that efficient because it was thought that there was nowhere for people to go. So at one point, I think in 2000, in the year 2000, all the detainees from WUNRA walked out and walked into town and refused to leave the center of town until their kind of demands for better facilities were met. And at that point, the companies, and these are private companies to whom detention centers are outsourced, started hiring kind of guards who were more mean. They started really actually kind of ramping up what I would call torture of detainees. Detainees responded by ramping up their attempts at protest or their kind of forms of political protest, which started, and at that point you started to see really intense forms of bodily protest happening. So a group of detainees sewed their lips together at WUMRA, and then there was another instance of that happening at a different detention center. People were going on hunger strike, and a lot of the kind of information about this was happening through lawyers, but also through people who had started organizing to visit detention centers and be in contact with detainees and be trying to kind of provide them with as many resources as they could, which is kind of one node of the coalition of groups who eventually organized the WUMRA protest in 2002. There were three main reasons that it kind of happened as it did and that it was as big as it was. Part of it was that people were starting to organize visits to detention centers, and there was a bus tour of activists that went to all the detention centers around Australia and filmed and had things like weblogs and were constantly updating them. There were a lot of detainees inside who were politically active. And at this point, also the kind of composition of the detainees had changed, where some of them had asylum claims that were outstanding, but many of them from Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan had been denied asylum, but they were being detained indefinitely because Australia didn't have deportation treaties with those countries. So a lot of the people in Wilmer at that point had been denied asylum, had appealed, had been denied their appeals, and then nobody knew what to do with them, or they wouldn't, they weren't about to release them. And so there was a sense of increasing desperation, I think, on the part of detainees, where some of them had been detained for 5, 6, 7 years by that point and couldn't actually see a way out of detention at all. So that was one of the things that was, things were kind of getting to this boiling point inside the detention centers. The other thing was that in the late 90s, early 2000s in Australia at the time, there was a really huge counter-globalization movement that had successfully mobilized against the World Economic Forum in Melbourne in 2000. And there was a lot of coalitional political energy that kind of was emerging across a really huge spectrum. So there were people in the Green Party, there were people in the kind of, in like the left segments of the Labour Party who were mobilizing, there were church groups, there were unions, there were environmentalists, and that energy didn't, there were kind of huge anarchists and autonomous groups who had organized around the World Economic Forum, and those people all still wanted to keep on organizing together, and detention seemed like the kind of obvious, really urgent political movement to get involved in. So the protest, I can't remember who came up with the idea that we should do a protest at Woomera, but a lot of different ideas had been floated. Some people were floating the idea of a flotilla of boats that would go to Indonesia and actually bring a huge number of asylum seekers to Australian shores. That seemed like it was pretty impractical and logistically difficult and would require a lot of resources. So someone came up with the idea of what people called a Festival of Freedom at Woomera and at Easter 2002. And it started off as a small group of people, but as it happened at the World Economic Forum, it was basically a kind of autonomous action where everybody was invited. It was organized around a spokes council model, so the idea was that no group would be able to make a decision about what happened, but that a whole lot of different groups would come and do different kinds of actions or bring different kinds of people together. And the idea was definitely to be in touch with detainees, so to be close to detainees, to show them that we saw what was happening to them. And I think that, you know, from the beginning stages, some people had the idea that this might result in a breakout, which is eventually what ended up happening. And the other important part of it was that there was a really big independent media movement happening in Australia at that time, which was, I guess, the way that I ended up getting involved. And so the indie media sites in every major city were happening. There was a really huge sense of being able to share information and also being able to use kind of new technologies of, you know, for instance, being able to record sound and then upload it to the internet, which seems like a really basic thing now, but then was actually very new technology that made the idea of going somewhere remote and then being able to transmit what was happening seemed really realistic and doable in a way that, because it was so isolated, lots of people had gone there, but they would have to wait, you know, a couple of days to kind of report back or to make public what was happening. And so, yeah, that's how the Woomera 2002 protest kind of was initiated, and at first there were working groups in every major city, and I was part of a working group in Melbourne that was coordinating all the different parts of it. But then people started organizing online, and it ended up, I think, 2,500 people ended up coming. There were buses. There were people who were on road trips who drove up. There were groups from all different kind of like running the gamut of the political spectrum. There were socialist groups. There were church groups. There were lots of people from the Green Party, which was probably the most left parliamentary party in Australia at the time. There were groups who had been doing immigration detention solidarity work for years at that point. There were anarchists. There was a black bloc. There were all sorts of people. There were lots of environmentalists. And there were also people who had been doing Indigenous solidarity work in South Australia and in that particular area who came. So it was a huge variety of people. I arrived with a group of people to start the camp, and we envisaged camping there for 4 or 5 days. And the first night was about taking space and keeping it while there was a sort of small group of people there. So basically, it felt very kind of scary because we were in a situation where the police definitely outnumbered us. And we had this weird kind of wagon circle where all the vehicles were parked in a circle to surround the campers. And the police raided us at 3 a.m. and tried to take some tents or whatever, but the vehicle structure kind of seemed to work. And then the next day, more people showed up, and the police started negotiating with us about maybe we'd like to camp in a football field in town, which was a couple of miles away. Obviously, people said no and stayed where they were. And then by the second day, there were so many people that the police were no longer able to move us, and they just had to let it happen.
Thanks to everyone who contributed to the show. We'll continue our conversation with Aaron next week and hope you'll tune in. This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512, or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on KiteLine at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening.